credit paying Ramosa finds the target. Swinton it was. There's a little short kick from Hodge, who gets the bounce. It's there for Banks. He flicks it out the back door, and a try on debut for Tom Wright. What a start, Australia!
Welcome to the Rugby Fixation. We're fixated on rugby and look to talk about it as often as we can. I'm your host, Mitch Evans, although you may know me as Rev, and today we're talking about the Wallabies versus England, and what a preview of the match that'll be. You can find us on Twitter at Rugby Fixation and get in touch as often as you like. At the moment, we've got some content that's out looking at the players that are missing from the Wallabies squad, as well as a bit of a look at some of the most capped players in the team and whereabouts they stand at the moment in terms of inclusion. This week, I'm going to be talking to JB from Egg Chasers. We got to have a great chat about the England team, about the Wallabies, and a little bit about the dynamics of the coaches and the players themselves. More importantly, I do like to go through the round reviews and some of the bits of news and previews for other games as well. All of that I was able to do in a unofficial Rugby Rumble on the Pick and Drive Rugby podcast. So go have a look on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast from, for Pick and Drive Rugby, which I'm sure you're already listening to if you're listening to me, where we go through all the debate and the discussion, all the different points around the Wallabies versus Scotland match. So without further ado, let's get into the preview. England versus Wallabies, what a match that shapes to be. Because I simply can't fill the space with my own musings, I've brought along a man who has more recorded rugby audio than anyone else on the planet. One of the hosts of the Egg Chasers Rugby podcast, the longest running podcast in the world, certified Negroni connoisseur and able to win more Twitter arguments before midday than I have my entire social media lifespan. I'm talking about Mr. Jonathan Beardmore, a.k.a. JB. Mate, how you going?
I'm all right, mate. How are you?
Very good.
Sorry.
Feeling good. Always a bit nervous. I'll try to record close to when the team lists are out. And then obviously we've seen the team list for England and Australia now. So there's plenty to dive in for. But I just wanted to get straight to the hard-hitting point just based off all the articles I've seen today. What are the chances of an Australian win this weekend?
I have no idea. I mean, genuinely, I know that sounds like a bit of a let-off, but I believe in Dave Rennie as a world-class coach. And the thing about Eddie Jones, you just don't know what's going to happen next. You know, he's the most winning coach, if that's even a word, in England history. I mean, he's got a better win percentage than any other coach. Yet he's also done the worst in the Six Nations. So, you know, anyone who knows what Eddie Jones is going to do next is a better man than me. On the other hand, I look at Dave Rennie and I think he's incredibly established. He knows exactly what he wants. And his teams seem to they're not predictable in the way that they play, but he's certainly predictable in the way that he coaches. And what I mean by that is he gives his team a sense of stability. He builds, whereas Eddie Jones is like the opposite, isn't he? He's destructive. Like, he builds via destruction. So how England go this weekend is anyone's guess.
And I think that's one of the interesting things. I like that you bring up the Six Nations, because that was a really just sort of all-over performance from a team that still looks really good on paper. But even then, I look at their build-up to this game, and, you know, a closer than it should have been win against USA. They beat Canada really convincingly. They beat Tonga really convincingly. Australia are a step up, but it's one of those things. I never know whether it's, you know, overly beneficial to smash a minnow and then have to play a stronger team next up. Like, are you battle-hardened for that? Or, you know, are Australia surprisingly in a better position because they had a tight game and a loss against Scotland, so they're now angry coming into it? Do you see this as any sort of advantage for England having those blowout wins?
I don't know. I look at it a different way. I think the England advantage is these players are hardened in the Premiership. And with the greatest respect to Super Rugby, you just don't get that hardness. And when you're coming up to the Northern Hemisphere, if you've got a bit of a bad day or a bit of rain, it's a bit cold or whatnot, I do think that definitely falls into England's favour, much more so than having played Tonga, because, you know, with respect to Tonga, so what? Who cares?
Yeah.
As for the Australian situation, again, you don't really know what mindset Australia has. Obviously, they're an awesome team with some awesome individuals. Maybe not quite to the standard they were at one time. I think every Australia fan would agree this probably isn't the golden age of Wallabies. Excuse the pun. But you never know what kind of mindset Australia come in with, because you've got to play the All Blacks, three times a year? And that can't be good for anyone's mentality.
That's one of the things that I hate when they do this as well, but Hooper's just come out and said that he doesn't find the task of challenging England that difficult because he has to play in New Zealand three times a year. But it's also one of those annoying comments that, yeah, that might be true, but that's just going into Eddie Jones's sort of, you know, pretty much speech. It's going to be, you know, going through the hallways of Twickenham, just knowing that, all right, boys, he doesn't think we're as hard as New Zealand, so let's show him. I just don't see why Australia seems to be the worst team for fueling the opposition with pre-match barbs.
Yeah, and let's just take that example a little bit further, right? So if I fought Mike Tyson in his prime three times a year and I got absolutely destroyed each and every time, it doesn't stack up to me that I'd be in any better situation to fight someone who's, you know, a near-peer adversary. And yes, I don't see why Australia would think getting smashed three times a year by New Zealand would be, broadly speaking, the same thing. But, you know, I guess psychologically you can say, look, we've seen the best in the world. They beat South Africa, did they not?
Yeah. Got them twice. So
wouldn't it be better to say, yeah, we beat South Africa, so I think we know what's around the corner? That would be a better thing to say, I'd say.
But, and that's the thing. I think Australian fans, and you've probably seen, like, we're very proud when we're winning, and let's just say not proud, the furthest thing from when we're losing. So it's always a massive swing. And I think coming to that Scottish test, nearly every Australian fan I spoke to was pretty much ignoring the match and like, yeah, let's just get to England. You know, we beat South Africa, who cares? Like, let's just, you know, have a real challenge. And now that we've lost that, it's all doom and gloom. People are saying, you know, all these atrocities. One thing that I thought you'd like is, I made it work today, said Australia are literally the worst team in the world at rugby. And I thought, well, there we go. That was one of my mates at work. So he wasn't a huge fan. And I thought, gee, that use of literally, that's going to go great for the Egg Chasers vernacular. I just thought, yeah, it's crazy how quickly it swings. Obviously, yeah, the Wallabies missing, I mean, Hooper's their best player, but I'd say Marika Corin-Betty, Simo Karevi, Quade Cooper, Taniela Tupou, probably the next four best players this year. Is it too early? What's that?
Quade's at home. I thought Quade is at home.
Yeah, so all four of those players are out. All four of Corin-Betty, Karevi, Cooper, and Tupou not playing. So is it too early to start using excuses? Like, do the Wallabies have a bit of a leg to stand on when it comes to, you know, not really being ready for this sort of encounter?
Well, maybe, because I used to be a Wales fan back in the day. You know, I used to love Wales. Not so bothered about them. But I remember when Wales would do the same thing, which is, oh my God, we've got 15 good players. And as soon as four of them were out, the world ended. But I think there's something beneficial to that, which is you get to find out who the next man up is. And quite often, it's not a case of, you know, they're as talented. But sometimes guys just thrive in the right opportunity. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. The other thing as well, Corin-Betty. He is a phenomenal, phenomenal rugby player. But he makes so many mistakes. And I'm not entirely sure if what he brings to the table in terms of his attacking prowess and the way he runs and the things that nobody else can do is worth it for the amount of drop balls he has, the amount of errors he makes. I mean, he's, like I say, he's probably one of the most talented individuals on the planet, but he does make a lot of mistakes. So I wouldn't be that bothered. Quade Cooper, you know, again, very talented individual. But why can't he just nail down a club job? Why can't he just be the guy who just steadily has a club job? And maybe that's why he's so good. Maybe it's that maverick mindset that sets him apart. But I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think at the highest level, rugby is a lot. Actually, listen, I'm talking a very Northern Hemisphere way here, because I spoke to Chris Boyd, the Northampton coach, a few weeks ago. And I was about to say, at the highest level, rugby is about not making mistakes. Chris Boyd would say, at the highest level, rugby is about taking your opportunity. So, I don't know, actually. I was going to say it's about not making mistakes, but maybe I'm completely wrong.
Well, I think that's probably lends itself really well to why we struggle against New Zealand so much and England. The Wallabies have gifted, I think, 8 intercept tries in their last 5 matches to New Zealand, 2 in the quarterfinal to England. I mean, like, every time they look like they might be in position, they throw an intercept, they give away needless penalties. Even that Scottish game, I thought Tom Wright, like that push and shove with Stuart Hogg, just really needless. And then that marched them up the field and gave them a great opportunity. But I like your point about Corin-Betty, because as much as he's probably the last person I want to try and tackle or have to defend one-on-one, like, he's just the hardest working player I've seen. Andrew Kellaway probably is a bit of a... Yeah. But Kellaway's probably that smarter player where he just positionally is so good. He doesn't make the line breaks, but he's always in the right spot to receive an offload or something like that. And a few people have brought up the point that it's probably a good chance to, you know, have players like himself and Wright on the wings against Tuilagi, who's a damaging ball runner. But, you know, we've got some pretty good defensive outside backs. Just on that, is the Tuilagi selection on the wing, I know he hasn't played there since 2014 for England, but is that a surprise? Is that really like a risky call, or the team stacked enough that it doesn't matter too much?
That's a great question. I think the way Eddie Jones looks at it, and I think more coaches should maybe take this approach, is can I just get my best 15 on the field? And I don't know if you remember this, but Eddie Jones went with Mike Brown on the wing and the tour of South Africa a few years ago, which I thought was insane. But actually, it worked really, really well. Manu Tuilagi is a far, far better athlete than Mike Brown is. And I imagine if you put Manu on the wing, or, you know, hey, if you put Manu anywhere in the back line, really, he's going to have an impact. It's not a bad selection. I guess it's the opportunity cost. How much are you taking away from Manu? But even with what you take away from him, is he still better than the next best person? Do you think a 15 with Manu in it, regardless of where he is better than a 15 with Adam Radwan in? Eddie does. I can see why. Tuilagi is a great guy. But the only thing I'd say about Tuilagi is he's kind of like cocaine. Like, you get addicted to it, then you can't get off him. And then when he's not there, there is a real, real problem for England. Same with Leicester Tigers. Tell Sharks manage him a lot better because they don't rely on him all the time. But when he's there, he's a luxury. But I do think England massively rely on Tuilagi, because one of the things they need to do, and they're not that good at, is bending the line in open play. Their set piece is great. They can do a lot of good things. Their defence is pretty aggressive. But what they're not able to do is bend the line with ball carriers, which is a bizarre thing considering how physical the players are, but they just can't. Manu does that job for them. So I guess that's why he's in the team.
I think similar with Tuilagi, we had a few games, I think four games with Samu Karevi this year. We just saw what a difference it was. Like, the back line could completely restructure itself. Like, he had a get out of jail free card if you needed hit up easy meters, just that gain line. And it is hard to structure the play around that. I know the Wallabies are going to be, you know, rocking a very young back line other than, you know, the halves and Beal at fullback. The wings and centers are really green. Is that probably the avenue that England are going to look to strike? Because I just look at the back line. I think they've got six survivors from the, or maybe five survivors from the back line from the World Cup quarterfinal. Whereas, you know, the Wallabies, it's just Beal at fullback. And this is his first test start for 2 years. So is the back line the way to go through the team?
Well, depends what phase England are in. You've got to remember, England are not. I mean, England might have similar names on the team sheet. Doesn't mean they're going to play in a similar way. So back to what I said right at the start of the conversation, which is Eddie destroys things. That's the way he operates. I'm not even sure who the attack coach for England is now. Is it Simon Amor still? Or have they gone through him and they're on someone else now? Is it going to be Jason Ryland for a little bit, which he's more of a skills coach, but he never showed up. They went through Ed, what's his name? The championship coach from Jersey. They went through someone before that. They're constantly turning people over. So what exactly England look like when they show up? Who knows? I mean, I know that sounds like a massive get out of jail call, but that is the Eddie way. Now, if you imagine, I've never heard a team do this before, ever, particularly not an international team. But if you remember the Autumn Nations Cup, that sham competition that we had just during COVID, England decided that they would focus on one aspect of the game, which I think was defence and physicality. And I think that is insane. I've never heard of an international team do something like that. And this is the Eddie Jones way. So what they decided to focus on coming into this next set of games now against Australia and whoever they've got after that, it's beyond me. It's beyond me. The players might be the same. Whether the system will be the same, the coaching definitely will not be the same. We'll just have to wait and see.
I think what I like about that is that Autumn Nations Cup, it is insane they did that, but they also won it, which just goes to show that, you know, I know it was against a weakened French side in the final, but still, like, it is insane how successful that was. And it shows Jones is such a mastermind. I think that's one of the things that made me really wish we had a full strength Wallabies, was every single game, Jones tactically outplayed Checker really easily. Like, Checker admitted he never did much analysis on the other team. Jones clearly did, and, you know, it showed, because they exploited the things we weren't good at, and there was a pretty decent list of things we weren't that great at the time. And one of the things I think, I guess, looking into this match is just with so many of the players sort of changing, I want to get a bit of an insight from Ollie Hoskins, because I know he's obviously playing the Premiership.
That's a good ball to mention him, yeah.
Yeah, I see he's only started 7 of the last 25 games for Irish, and you know, no disrespect to Irish, they haven't been they're doing all right this season in some moments, but they haven't been a top team. So is he, you know, really going to be a saviour for the Wallabies, or is it just a desperate call?
It's a great question, right? So on Irish, I'll give you the full Irish lowdown. Like, London Irish are a team which are built to withstand the threat of relegation, which is why you got all these highly paid Australians. To be honest, I didn't even know Hoskins was an Australian until yesterday. I had no idea. I thought he came through the academy, or he was a South African or something. I had no idea that he was Australian. But as a pack, London Irish do pretty well. Now, that could be because they've got two of the highest paid second rows in the entire club game, or it could be because Hoskins and co are pretty good. Now, I don't know why he's only played 7 games, but I have seen quite a lot this year. Irish have only won 1 game, but that was away at Exeter Chiefs. They've drawn a further 3, one which is away at Saracens, one at home to Sale. So against the top teams, the most physical teams, they do bloody well. Now, on Hoskins himself, I really couldn't tell you if he's going to step up and be a world-class prop. I couldn't say that. But I would say, look at the Welsh example. So Wales go through all sorts of individuals that you'd never expect to be world-class, and it's usually a need thing. Who was talking to me about this? Your countryman, Ben Darwin, talks about this all of the time, which is sometimes you end up with a player, not because he is the best in his position, but because you have no other options. And it's not always bad. So Wales ended up with Thomas Francis, who for the first year or two was not an international player. Then towards the end of his tenure with Gatland, he was probably one of Wales' most important players. And there's no reason why Hoskins can't become that guy if he just performs a role in the team, because that's all you need him to do, right? You need him to look after his set piece, defend around the rucks, do bits and pieces. And if he does that, I think you're going to have a fine player. And I think he probably is more than capable of doing that.
The thing that I think reassured a lot of Aussie fans just when they saw the video of him getting named in the squad and seeing the emotion was nice, but someone posted his stats saying he's 191 centimetres, 128 kilos, something like that. And I'm like, that's a decent chunk of man, you know, like that'll do. And I mean, especially if he comes on late and he's got Skelton pushing behind him, that's pretty handy. And just with the mention of Skelton, we've seen this late inclusion of Latu, Arnold, Skelton and Beale from France. Given you've chatted with Ben Darwin, he would have mentioned cohesion. Does it seem like a bit of a, you know, bit of a safety net they've just thrown out to get all these players in? Because Rennie named a 37-man squad before the first match. 6 of the players were unavailable either through injury or Japanese contracts. Are these the players that, you know, you see getting to a World Cup, or it's just literally a fail-safe for right now? Come in and do a job.
Yeah, so this is like the Alwyn Jones thing, right? Is Alwyn Jones good enough to play a World Cup today? Yeah, of course he is. Is he going to be good enough in 2 years' time? Well, we don't know. My view is, if they're good enough to play a World Cup today, they should be in the squad. And until they're not good enough to play a World Cup, well then, you know, we'll make that decision then. But the guys that you mentioned are easily good enough. And not only are they easily good enough, I think when you bring guys like that in, some fellas in that squad, and this does, I'm not trying to sound patronising here, but they won't know what world-class looks like until they see world-class. And I have no doubt that someone like Curtie Beale will add something which they've not seen for a long, long time. And just being around these players. I mean, you'll know this from playing rugby yourself. You will run around with your mates, and then one guy comes in who is substantially better than everyone else, and everyone else tries to play up to that level. The pros are no different. I think Beale will add something substantial to that squad.
Yeah. Just on that, we had a... I think it was my under-16 team. We had a player come down from a school that was much better than us. He was our number 8, and throughout the season scored 3 times more points than our goal kicker. Like, he just tries for fun. It just became ridiculous. And we thought, you know, we had some good players, and yeah, just leagues ahead. Just on one of the things you said at the start, I really like the sort of mention of how the Premiership sort of changes the way players play, and that's the big difference between the Premiership and Super Rugby. Endo from the Pick and Drive Rugby podcast mentioned that I think Marcus Smith had over 100 professional games under his belt already, or close to. And Noah Lolasio, who's, you know, roughly his counterpart, similar age and similar position, has 25, I think. You know, just and he's had a few injury hampered seasons, but it does show the massive gulf between the number of fixtures you fit in into a year. So when I see players like Bevan Roden, Rafi Quirk, and you know, some young players and some, you know, uncapped players coming through, these guys probably played a whole lot of fixtures already. Who are you most excited for out of this young crop of England players coming up?
Well, good question. So, I mean, Rafi Quirk, I think, is... Sorry, it's Quirk. It's not Quirk, it's Quirk, as I keep getting reminded. Rafi Quirk is a phenomenal talent. Like, absolutely... Oh, hi. Absolutely phenomenal. So, he'll be good. Bevan Rod, let's talk about him for a second. So, a young Lucid... I think he's, what, 21 now? He can't be much over that. I watched him play for Sale Sharks when he was 19, and he did the most outrageous offload out the back door against Leicester Tigers when they completely routed them at home. And I thought, this guy is special. He's already been up against La Rochelle, and they're absolute mutants. I think his opposite man was Weenie Antonio. Have I got that right? Weenie Antonio? Was that the guy? Anyway. The enormous French prop. And behind him, he had Will Skelton. Now, he didn't do well. He didn't do great that day. I'm not going to lie. But he's been around. He knows the lay of the land. I expect he will be very good. Whether he's going to be as good as Morley, I mean, I can't see that. I can't see that for a couple of years. But he's going to be very good. He is definitely one to watch. Out of the two, between him and Quek, I think Quek will make the bigger impact more quickly.
Yeah. I think one of the things with Bevan Rod, because he isn't a household name in Australia and probably not in England either at the moment, we got quite excited thinking, oh, great. Like, we've just lost Tupou and Alalatoa. The best thing that could happen for our inexperienced tight heads is to come up against Bevan Rod. And then some of us sort of thought about, well, actually, Marcus Smith is barely older than him and carved up for, you know, every team he's played for. So whether that ends up being a good thing or not remains to be seen. The other selection issue that I just wanted to touch on, and I know that this is obviously something that gets brought up a lot. It's even, you know, got Cocker's Law as a title, you know, because you can't make a change without having someone come in to replace. But the back row seems to be the contentious part for some of my mates, and even some of my English mates that look at that and think, how come Dom Brandt or Simmons aren't in there? The combination they've got at the moment with Laws, Curry and Underhill, is that the best combination in your opinion? Is that the combination you're happy to see them running out with?
I think it's a compromise, isn't it? Yeah. And I think if you don't have a really hard ball-carrying number eight, like a Dwayne Vermaelen somewhere, if you don't have that guy, your second best option is what Australia did when they had, well, not do, they did, when it was Hooper and Pocock. Sorry, I've just got to move rooms. Yeah, so for me, it's a compromise, right? So if you don't have a ball-carrying number eight, who can make space in heavy traffic, like a Vunipola, which they do have, actually. They just decided not to use him. Or Vermaelen or someone like that, a real brute. Your second best option is to do what Australia did, which is Pocock and Hooper. You've got to replace the physicality with a volume of work rate. I think it worked very well for Australia. You sometimes see New Zealand doing the same thing with Ardie Surveyor. I think if Ardie Surveyor had his choice of positions, it'd probably be a seven rather than an eight. And I think putting Tom Curry at eight is, I wouldn't say it's masterful, but it's useful. Tom Curry can actually carry the ball very well. And the only time he's going to have to be exposed as an eight as such is going to be at the back of the scrum. And England aren't going to go backwards, or I doubt that they are. I mean, if you're going to be an eight for anybody with limited experience, I think England would probably be your better option. Yeah. So it's not too much of a problem. Now, on Simmons and Dom Brandt, we can break those two boys down individually. Dom Brandt is a guy who picks his moments. If that opportunity is available for him to go forward, he'll take it, and he's bloody brilliant. But if there are no opportunities, he's not going to make his own. And I think that would be the big difference between someone like him, Vunipola, or a Vermaelen. On Simmons, he's a brilliant athlete. The problem with Simmons, of course, is that he's too small. So we call it the Simmons tax, which is Exeter have to play enormous men everywhere in order to make up for Simmons' lack of weight. Because he's not a huge man. Like, he will claim that he's about 105, 110 kilograms. He's probably more like 100. So, you know, Exeter have got to have 2 6-foot-4 enormous Zimbabweans on either flank just to make sure that they can go forward. Don't think that's a novelty or so. I don't think that's a thing you can do in international rugby. So hence we've got Kerry.
I think that's probably why it's such a good time for them to trial that against Australia. Like having the 6-2 split's an interesting call when we don't have a strong forward pack. But when you look at the team, Rob Liotta's pretty fresh. So is Rob Valentini. I don't think they're going to cause massive headaches for England. And then the other option, Pete Samu off the bench. Again, he's sort of that really versatile 6, 7, or 8 option. He's played across them. Again, not a massive body. So if they're going to see if they can match it, this is kind of a perfect opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how Australia go about beating England, though, because England are beatable. They're always beatable. I think they're one of the more fragile physical teams on the planet. So I've seen Wales pick them apart in the most unlikely way. I've seen South Africa bully them. I've seen lots of teams beat England in different ways. I think if Australia can pick a style of rugby that can expose England, they will do so. What you can't afford to do with England is let them get on the front foot. As soon as they're on the front foot, they will beat you up severely. And you also can't allow them to score early. If they score early, they're off to the races. But because they play in such a physical way, what I've found in the past, at least, is that they punch themselves out. So they might score early points and then they fade.
Yeah, that was one of the things that blew me away with that World Cup semi-final between them and New Zealand. Still one of the games that I watched the whole thing thinking, oh, New Zealand will come back, don't worry. They'll come back. And the whole bar that I was in watching that, they were just amazed because England just had this resolve that they were like, okay, we've got the points on the board, just park the bus. Literally from fifth minute, just like, okay, 7-0 up. If we get penalties, take them. Otherwise, just defend. And it was insane. And I like, I do think England do have some areas where, you know, we could attack them. But one of the things that got brought up so often, it is a great point, is I don't think Australia has something that they can fall back on if things get tough. I don't think there's something that they're world class at. I think they're probably just a really well-rounded team that can do some amazing things at times. But, you know, South Africa have this awesome forward pack that they can call on to do, you know, inhuman things. New Zealand has this back line that can just counterattack from anywhere and score points like you can't believe. But I don't really see what Australia has at the moment that no other team can do. And that's one of the things that I want them to try and find. I know Rennie, and yep, maybe this game's a great opportunity.
That's so interesting. It's exactly what I think about Australia, which is good players. Not great players, but good players. Yeah. No team identity.
Yeah.
Like, we know what England are. We know what South Africa are. We know what New Zealand are. You know, they've all got very distinct personalities. I wonder if this has something to do with the way that Australia developed their players as well. I mean, maybe it's not so much the case now, but certainly historically. How many players have you had who are multi-positional? Like, you've played Kirkley Beale at 15, 13, 12, 10. Yeah. You've played multiple, I mean, Izzy Folau, 15, 11, 13. Historically, Gitto, 9, 10, 12, 15 probably at some point. The list of these guys goes on. Phenomenal rugby players, are they phenomenal at one position though? And I just wonder if it's because it's almost like Australia put more of a premium on being able to do everything rather than just one thing well. In fact, or just on that, that's why I used to love Pat McCabe when he played. One thing, does it well.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that probably needs to be mentioned. When I look at the back line this weekend, James O'Connor has played literally every position bar halfback.
Yeah, of course.
So that's he's probably played less 10 than any other position. Hunter Paisami, he's played 12 tests. He's already done inside and outside center. Andrew Kellaway, both wings and fullback. Tom Wright, both wings. Kirtley Beale, obviously, as you said, everywhere. Len Niketau is the only back that's played in just the one position, and it's only been 12 games. So we don't have that identity because I think we try and get brought up saying that, you know, versatility is the key. If you can play every position, you'll get picked in a team. And what it's left us with is a whole lot of backs that are probably really good 23 bench options because they could cover a lot of spots, but not that many genuine out-and-out starters, especially when you take out a Corin Betty, who is just an 11. Like, he is just a left wing, nothing else.
I mean, if you've got all of these boys, like all the guys that you've listed there, generally speaking, Australian players have very, very good skills. But exactly as you said, when you have one guy who can be a focal point, like Karevi, someone like that. Who was the guy at the Brumbies? I don't think he's not in the squad at the moment, but historically, 6 foot, what the hell's his name? Like the 6 foot four centre, runs through everything, absolute beast.
Oh, yeah, Kieran Drani. Yeah.
You know, it just gives you a focal point. So all of those skills have an outlet. They have an end result.
Yeah. Well, Kieran Drony was one of those players. He was a terrible fantasy option because all he'd do is 10 runs for minimal meters, like eight from eight tackles, you know, just like awesome defender, but he wouldn't do anything flashy. He was just had the exact same role. He doesn't pass. He doesn't offload, well, very rarely offloads. It's just truck it up, suck in defenders, and you knew what he was going to do every time. It was probably the safest just pick like in the Wallabies.
Just like Jamie Roberts back in the day.
Yeah.
If he ran into traffic, he'd make 3 yards. If he had an open field, he'd make 3 yards.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's the kind of play, if they made a break, they'd be so lost as to what to actually do with it. Like the number of times they got tries, it was really just a, you know, a pick and drive or something that a forward would expect. But before we get to predictions, just one thing I want to check in with, because I know because the Wallabies held the Rayburn Shield for a little while, it's been talked up a little bit here, despite not being a tangible thing and being, you know, only fairly sort of new in rugby lexicon, at least in these parts. Does it mean anything to you if South Africa get the win for England to have a chance at it tomorrow, or is it really a nice novelty but not really a huge talking point?
I don't think it's a talking point for the fans, to be honest, but I'm pretty sure it is a massive deal for the players, a massive deal. Like any bit of silverware, even if it's just between two teams, for those players is absolutely enormous. So they will be talking about that. In fact, I know that they are. I don't think fans care really, do they? They find Twickenham to have a few beers at £7 a go. Although that's probably cheap now. Get hammered and go home. They couldn't get less. Which is the way it should be, by the way. That's exactly how I would be approaching the game if I was at Twickenham this weekend.
Yeah, and that's what makes World Cup so good, is you walk into any bar, you don't really care who's playing, you just have a great night. Like, oh yeah, I think I saw some rugby in between the third and fourth. Yeah,
went to Japan to watch the World Cup, thinking I'd get some really good insights into what happened. Don't remember a single game. I don't remember a single second of a single game. I remember the warm up of England and Argentina. That is it.
My biggest memory, because I was in Japan as well. We were in some Irish pub that was just sort of everywhere. And I was watching Island vs. Japan, and Squidge happened to be in the same pub. I thought, oh, this is cool. Like, you know, that's a YouTube rugby royalty. I'll have a chat. Couldn't for the life of me remember what I said to him. I just remember there's one photo where I've got Google Translate open, trying to talk to these Japanese guys, arms wrapped around as we've won. But, you know,
Squidge is a fascinating guy. Yeah. I think he's one of the keenest intellects in all of rugby. I think his stuff's superb, actually.
That's why I'm so upset I can't remember any of it. I remember talking about Hooper and that's it. So, look, I'm very excited for the match. I'm not particularly confident of a win this weekend from a Wallabies perspective. I just think there's a fair bit stacked against us, and that England team does look really damaging sort of across the board. But what would your tip be for the match? How much are you expecting you know, the result to swing?
I think England are going to score first. I think Tom Curry will score first. And I think that England will win something like 25-15.
Wow.
That's what I think. I don't know. I do not know.
Look, I'm nearly at the point where I'd be happy with that, because I look at some of the past results and there's been some real blowouts. I think, you know, some of the fixtures have just, they've been close for maybe the first 50 or 60 and then England just really run away with it. And I've got nightmares from Kirtley Beale letting that ball bounce and stay in, and just, I think it was six all at that time or so. It was really close and then they just ran away with it. So I'm concerned. I'd probably have them tipped. I think I tipped them by 14 or 15. So, I mean, hey, if your margin's good, I'll be very happy with that. I'd be stoked. But JB,
what a fall from grace. The Wallabies, the world's best team at one point, happy with a 10-point loss. It's tragic.
I will say, and it's showing my age a bit, I have probably only been a fan of the Wallabies since 2005 was when I started watching them quite intently. And so I was 11 at the time and getting into them, and saw them, I think, Versen beat South Africa. And I was like, oh, awesome. I'll get on board. And so in that time, they've never been the number one team. So I don't have that same sort of opinion, I guess. So whenever I talk to the generation above, they're always like, oh, I can't watch it anymore. We used to be so good. Whereas for me,
so good. If you remember the 2001 Lions test, which of course you wouldn't because you were into it like 3 or 4 years later. Mm. But my good, they were my word, they were good. Obviously, Gregan and Larkham, but those were, I mean, those were the good guys, the best guys. But it was that layer underneath. I mean, I always talk about Graham Bond, who is one of the finest rugby players that I've seen in a long, long time. Nobody knows who he is. He went to Sale Sharks. He was absolutely superb. He destroyed the Lions on his own from either 10 or 12. And you know, I think he played 12 for the Brumbies. I think Pat Howard played 10. Pat Howard and Graham Bond, two lads that you don't really think of now. I mean, you do actually, because Pat Howard went on to do great things in coaching and being an executive and whatnot. But two phenomenal players weren't getting in the Wallabies anytime soon.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's fallen such a long way, and you know, it could be a whole other podcast, but just the amount of money that goes into rugby league, and there's so little attraction, I think, to playing it. And as we said at the start, Australians love winners, and if the Wallabies aren't winning, there's just not people buying into it or getting that keen. Yeah, so it, yeah, massive talking point for another day. We won't bore it now, but Jamie,
well, let's do that another time. I'd love to have that conversation.
That'd be a great one, because I think that is genuinely one of the big issues just coming through at the moment, just how much other sports just taking away. And you know, reliving the glory days might be a good excuse to go back and rewatch some of the 91-99 World Cup, see some of the Lions tours of old, and just see how they stack up, because the 2013 one is very quick and easy to forget, just from my perspective. Look, JB, I really appreciate you coming on and having the time to chat. I think it's always insightful to get, you know, advice and words from people in the know, and clearly there's no rugby podcast that's been around or done more than Egg Chasers. So for people listening, where can they find you or listen to you and get in touch?
So they can find us at Rugby Podcast on Twitter, but don't bother, it's a cesspit, and there's no one worth really talking to on there. You can email us, because for some reason our email just goes wild. People love to have the people tend to have long messages for us, which you can't get across on Twitter. So that's contact eggchasers@gmail.com. But most importantly, download the podcast. So that is the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast. There's also the Rugby Dungeon Podcast, which is me doing long-form interviews with the greats and the good of the game. And lastly, we occasionally put up YouTube videos, and that depends if I've been disciplined enough to attend that week's Premiership press conferences. And if I have, I'll break them down on there for whoever's interested. So those are the ways to find me. If you really want to find me, AJ Bell Stadium every other weekend.
Fantastic. And there'll be people will be buying tickets to England just for the excuse, I'm sure. That is bound to be a treat. So thanks very much. And tune in again next week as we go through what will hopefully be a Wallabies win.